Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Welcome to this podcast on behalf of UK Investor Magazine, and it's also supported by Fund Edge. Fund Edge is an AI platform that makes sure that investors have a decent choice and a clever choice as to where to actually put their money. I'm Michael Wilson. I'm joined, as usual, by David Buick.
Greetings,
Michael. And one of Britain's best-known business figures, Martin Sorrell, joins us,
who's
chairman.
In his own mind, in his mother's mind.
Chairman and founder of S4 Capital, as we speak. You spent some time in the States following football. Is football for...
Not only following football.
No, of course, but you went to some matches.
We're doing a film, a joint film with a film producer of the World Cup for FIFA and for Disney. So Disney are going to distribute it cinematically. So it finished on July the 19th on the final day.
Do you think, having been there,
yeah,
that football is for investors or for the fans?
It's for both, actually. I think the much maligned FIFA plan actually was a good plan. I probably got shot for saying that, because it brings financial private equity money into football at a world level, which, by the way, it is permeating virtually every league and every aspect of football around the world. I mean, this week, Liverpool is the Fenway, the owners of Liverpool, I think, are trading part of their equity to another group, bringing another outside private equity. Jeff Bezos is part of the syndicate, apparently. But that's just one example of the private capital or public capital invading, if that's the right word, that certainly the traditionalists will think about it that way, football. So it permeates it at the league level with La Liga and the Bundesliga, where you're seeing CVC make investments, a private equity firm. It permeates it. I mean, the irony about all this is, look at the foreign investment in football clubs. I mean, the Premier League is dominated by foreign money, American and Saudi Arabian and UAE money. I mean, so there's the interesting thing is that 70% of football's revenue accrues to five major nations: England, France, Germany, Italy, and Spain. And what this is all about, I mean, I would acknowledge that I don't think FIFA and the president presented the plan, communicated the plan in the most effective way. But as a way of bringing private capital into the game and building it, and you have to look, when you look at the revenues that accrue to FIFA, which in this cycle, this last quadrennial, was about $15 billion, and compare it to over 4 years, so roughly $4 billion a year, when you compare it to, ironically, the revenues of the Premier League and UEFA, who are complaining bitterly about the way it was done, they dwarf what comes out of FIFA. And of course, obviously, there is an opportunity to build the base in the US. And I would just point out that there are about 2.6, 2.7 billion people on the planet that don't play football, principally in China and India. There are lots of fans there, but they don't play it. So there's a lot of opportunity and room to take the game beyond its traditional area, that 70% of revenue that accrues to those five nations. And what this is really about, in my view, probably two things. One is frequency. I mean, when people thought about what might happen when private capital was injected into FIFA or FFE, was that it might become too commercial. And we might have too frequent. That's one aspect of it. But the real fundamental problem is that this is a tug of war between the traditionalists and the purists, those five nations that I mentioned that control 70% of the revenue, and the other nations. So, you know, there was that great furore about going to 48 nations competing in the World Cup, which I think made the World Cup an even more interesting when you had Cabo Verde and other sides, African sides, for the first time, not winning or getting to the semi-finals, but certainly being contenders, broadening, democratizing football. What I think President Infantino is about, I mean, a lot of people comment on his motives, but one of the things he's about is about globalizing football, democratizing it. And I think that is super important to understand. So in a funny way...
if I may say so, elucidating exactly what the public doesn't get. We're getting a proper, transparent conversation.
FIFA, the president, have admitted they made mistakes in the communication. Yeah. They should have, I think, this is all benefit of 2020 hindsight, come out in front of it and said, look, this is a plan. Think about it. Consider it. If you think it's a good idea, we'll take it forward. But what it does is it takes the game to another level. If you look at America, the dominant sport is the NFL, American football, followed by...
Basketball, then
baseball. And probably football now, as a result of the Club World Championship last year, the World Cup this year, the Women's World Cup in Brazil next year, which will be a big tournament, the Olympics in LA in 28, and then we'll have the Women's Club World Cup as well. All these tournaments are going to take soccer, they call it in America, to a different level and make it very competitive with baseball, with basketball, and with the NFL. But when you look at the revenues that are generated by FIFA, as I say, $4 billion a year, and if you look at the investor memorandum that was put up, it was projecting that maybe over the next two cycles it would double.
Yep.
So there was a concern about frequency. You know, would we have a World Cup every 2 years? Would we have a Club World Cup every 2 years? And whether that would be too much, the impact on the players, and I get that. And that has to be discussed and thought through. But the fundamental thing was it was introducing private capital into a sport which at other levels is all there.
Yeah.
And people accept it. It was the way that it was done. And, you know, the involvement of the Kushner family, I don't think helped either, obviously, from some points of view. But look, benefit 2020 hindsight, it should have been done in a different way. But the fundamental idea was a super good one. And by the way, I think it would have been super good for FIFA, super good for FFE, super good for the associations, and for the sport generally, because it would raise its level in the US market, which is, no, it's... The US, point out, from a GDP point of view, is 30 trillion out of 120 trillion. It's one quarter of the world's economy. China, which doesn't play football, is 20. India is now in the top five. I think it's the fourth largest economy in the world. It's about five. So you put that little lot together and start thinking about what the potential is. It's huge.
But
at the end of the day, it's a fight. I mean, it's a very personal fight because Seferin and Infantino obviously have a personal animus, which is a real problem. But the real heart of this is, it's in a way, it's a funny way, it's rather like the sort of G7 against the BRICS and the next 11, if I can put it that way. It's the old and the new. The old want to cling on. It's a great, I mean, the Premier League is a great export for us. 70% of revenue from football comes to five nations.
Yeah. Can we push on, really go a bit parochial, because it's very important to us? We've now had the Burnham administration for a couple of weeks.
And a holiday as well.
Yeah. And we had one or two little tidbits thrown, which I think are irrelevant, but they're going to cost money. What do you think, Sir Martin, about the appointment of John Healey as Chancellor of the Exchequer? Is taxation going to come in a big way?
Look, I think it's a safe pair of hands. I mean, when I read that announcement, I thought that was his reward for starting the ball rolling when he resigned from the Starmer cabinet. Maybe that's unfair, but I think it's a safe pair of hands. And I'm sure, you know, when you look at, I remember sitting outside. One conservative minister's waiting room, and looking, they had the pictures of the heads of the civil service and the heads of the secretary of state on the wall, and you counted up, it was roughly you know, there were three or four ministers for every civil servant that changed. So there's always change. So we get somebody who's intelligent, able, like a Healy. I'm sure he'll be fine. Whether it's the right policies or not is another question. I mean, he'll grasp his brief. He'll, you know, he'll be diligent. He'll be hardworking. You know, he'll be well prepared, thoughtful, etc. But the question is, you know, what can they do given the situation? And I think inevitably, getting to the heart of your question, we will see increases in taxes. I wouldn't be surprised to see increases in income tax. I wouldn't be surprised to see increases in capital gains tax. I wouldn't be surprised to see increases in exit taxes to prevent, you know, to discourage people from leaving. There is an exodus. And it's not just, I think the exodus is much more serious than people really understand. It's not about the rich people or old people like me. It's really the young people that it's, you know, if you're a 35-year-old person, man or woman, and you have a decent business, let's say it's a business making 10, I mean, I'm quoting examples of people who I've spoken to, you know, doing about 10 million a year in turnover, doing, you know, a couple of million in profit, and you're 35, and you're thinking about, you know, you retire when you're 65 or 70, you know, work out the discounted present value. And you can by the way, the fundamental thing is you can do what you do anywhere.
Yeah.
Now, because in a digital distributed economy, you know, you can pick where you want to be, and it's fluid and varied. You know, you work out the discounted present value of that stream of profits at, you know, a high tax rate, low tax rate. It's a no-brainer. So people are going to leave. And I think what you have to do is, you know, I hate the use of the word working people.
I'm a working person.
I mean, what is the? I think one Labour minister did try to define it, and it was, I think it was defined as somebody, a non-working person was somebody who owned shares. I think that was the definition that was used, which is rubbish, because everybody owns shares through their pension schemes. Yeah. Same is true in America. We're seeing similar sort of things happening in America to some extent, with particularly in the Democratic Party. But look, at the end of the day, I think my belief is incentives work, not disincentives. And so there has to be a shift in the system. And if you look at it, I mean, without going into the gory detail, I remember earlier this year saying to a well-known ex-Labour politician, you know, if you were back in power, what would you do? And he said, it was interesting, this is somebody from, I would say, describe it as sort of centre-left or centre of the Labour Party. And he said five things. One is, instead of talking about growth, you know, I'd implement some growth policies. Number two is the NHS, obviously, we have to support, but there's a fair amount of wastage and we want to look at that. Number three, welfare payments have just gone too far. There are too many people, you know, out of work who are maintained with allowances beyond
swinging the ledge,
just too much. Number three, defense policy. You know, whether we like it or not, the Americans are shifting their attitude towards NATO and Europe. Maybe when there's a change of president, you know, maybe if it was Vance or Rubio, it wouldn't change, but maybe beyond that, it will change. And then the last point was technology and AI. Those were the five areas that he identified. And it's somebody that I would have, you know, if I was a voter, I would vote for in a heartbeat in terms of even as he was a Labour politician. Those are the five areas. And now, easy to say generally, you have to come up with specific policies. But I think basically what you have to do is incentivize people to do better. You know, I don't think, you know, this is a very contentious point. I don't think putting VAT on private schools piece does anything. I think that's a sort of class-based
nonsense
thing, which destroys the fabric. I mean, whether you think, and I get the point about private education being for the privileged few, I get that. But it is part of the fabric of this country, and it's being destroyed.
It's called choice as well.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I think, the values are changing, the approach is changing, the country is changing, and we're in a weaker position as a result. So we need very strong leadership in order to right the ship, I think.
Do you think that Burnham, who's so said in the past, in the very brief public past, as you said, at least, as Prime Minister, said he wouldn't be a prisoner of the bond markets, and yet...
Well, he is.
Very few people, I think, understand them, but for the purposes of this, that's... The goodness of strangers, if you like, as Carney
well,
said,
I think,
that's
I think,
keeping us look, going. Has he done enough to keep the bond markets quiet?
Well, for the moment, we haven't seen anything yet. I mean, you know, we're in the
because they would like
dog
tax
days
increases.
Dog days of summer, and you know, he's gone on holiday, albeit for a week. He's now back, and what's he doing? He's doing the intelligent thing, which is he's going around the country. He's going to listen. I mean, I think what will be very interesting is to see whether he goes to the country early. If I was him in his position, I was talking to one or two people who think there's a 50-50 chance that we'll have a general election before Christmas. And the more I think about it, when you hear him talk about a 10-year plan, what is that saying? That's saying, I need 10 years to get it done. He could get a 5-year mandate if he held an election and won. I think if he went to the country, he would have a reduced majority. I think Farage has lost momentum for good reasons or bad. I'm not commenting on that, but I think he's lost momentum. I think Kemi Badenoch is gaining momentum quite significantly. And the longer he waits, the more momentum she will get. I mean, she's winning more praise. Her personal ratings are getting improving, and I think she's quite strong. And if I was him,
do you think the country's starting to listen again
to her?
Yeah.
Yes, I think so. I think she's been very forthright. You know,
I think she's great, but I mean, it just struck me.
You know,
that
for example,
are not
around anti-Semitism. You know, whether you agree with her or not, she takes a position, and I think people like that, and they people admire that and respect that. With Burnham, we're yet to see the colour of what he does. I mean, I was very struck when he won Makerfield, he had that group of people behind him, and they all had little, I think they were pink or pink hearts with the word Andy on them. And I looked at that and I thought, well, this is what this is about. This is about Andy. It's not about policy, not about change. It's not about, you know,
about
incentives.
Yeah.
It's not about economics. It's about Andy. and you know, Andy's one of the boys, one of the lads. He likes football. He likes going down to the pub and everything. And he's a man of the people. And he's moving things to the North Wing, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. But if you think that by moving the Downing Street to the north, you're going to solve the country's ills, think again. I mean, it's much more fundamental than that. But he did a good job in Manchester as mayor. But this is a different scale of job. Different scale of experience, and as one reporter said to me, he's a very good footballer. Apparently, he plays football very well.
That's a nice way of putting it. One of the things that's cropped up in the last couple of days, emanating from comments made some time ago, that it was thought that Jim O'Neill, ex of Goldman Sachs, and Andy Haldane, ex chief economist in the Bank of England, were going to be his personal advisors.
Yes,
the silence is deafening.
Well, I think it's early days, to be fair, David.
Okay.
I mean, and goodness knows what's going on in the background. And I think that was good news. I think both of those people are, you know, Jim O'Neill, Brixton Next 11. I mentioned that before, and you know, he was the propagator of that. So I think they would talk a lot of common sense around the sort of things that you, Michael, and I would approve of, but. It's important that they do have an influence and they get things done. You know, what you see and what you get are two different things. So we have to wait. Look, on Burnham, I think you wait, you see what he's going to come out with, and then you make a judgment. You have to give him a chance. The risk is, you know, in 3 months we'll be back to where we were with Starmer. And we have to see. But it's early days. I don't think you can make any judgments in fairness at this stage.
Do you think, just a final thing, because I think Mark and I really wanted to discuss AI with you, just What worries me is debt. And, you know...
Well, he has very little room to manoeuvre. I mean, he can alter the definition of things.
Can you see him cutting, though? That would be my concern.
Well, I think he is a prisoner of the bond market, whether he likes it or not. And your government borrowing rates have risen. They flipped up over 5% for the first time for a long time. We have to see how it plays out. I mean, the general economic atmosphere probably doesn't help him. You know, if anything, if you listen to the so-called experts in America, they're looking for rates probably more to increase rather than decrease. And here, probably the same. They're worried about inflation. You know, inflation is stubborn at around 3.5. Central banks have all said they want to get it to 2. They failed miserably to do that. And I think we're going to live in a world where growth is harder to find, where inflation is more stubborn than people think, and where, as a result, efficiency is going to become more important. So that plays to the importance of AI and technological efficiency. But interest rates are going to be higher than they have been before, and that we thought they were going to be. In that world, actually, to what we're discussing, choosing geographies becomes really important. So if you're a global company, where do you go? Certainly, US is on steroids at the moment. I mean, corporate earnings are off the charts. I was struck, Palantir Q2, 160% increase in revenue. I mean, it defies belief. The top four hyperscalers are going to spend $5 trillion between them. So that's Microsoft, Alphabet, Meta, and Amazon are going to spend $5 trillion between 25 and 30 on CapEx. Now, Google's spending $200 billion. Amazon's this year going to spend $240 billion. Meta, $140 billion. I mean, it's incredible. And against ad spend, ad spend for most of these companies might be 10, 20, 25. But when you actually media spend is probably 1 week's CapEx. I mean, it's extraordinary. Extraordinary what's happening.
Mind-blowing.
Now, this is the railroads being built out. And as we saw with the railroads, there'll be people that fail. So this is a huge boom. And you saw last night in America, David Solomon, Larry Fink, Jensen Wang, all putting together this consortium, if you like, to fund
data,
AI data centers and all the issues around them. So the Americans get it. I mean, you've got to admire what they're doing. And it is on
steroids. They don't faff around the peripheries, do they?
EPS in Q2 of this year in the S&P 500 is over 20%. Exclude the hyperscalers, you're sort of high double digits. 7 consecutive quarters of double-digit EPS growth. I mean, this is unbelievable. And most people say, when is it going to stop, right? I spoke to the CEO of major engineering, European-based engineering company. He said his order, I said, when's the AI thing going to stop? He said, well, my order book is full until 2030. So this is of heavy engineering, AI-related engineering. So we are in a boom time, but it's very K-shaped, okay? Meaning, I think Scott Bessent has called it C-shaped. I didn't quite follow that, but to me, it's K-shaped. So you've got a lot of inequality as a result. And that's driving a lot of the political stuff that we were talking about before. So you have people who are benefiting extraordinarily well from it and people who are suffering as a result. And of course, the big issue around AI is whether it's going to actually cut jobs in the end or not. We can discuss that. But look, it's a very funny world. So given all that, which are the big areas? US, very strong.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very bullish on Latin America. I'm bullish on Mexico. I'm Colombia.
Politically stable
Brazil.
Enough to be politically stable enough for you to be positive.
People, it does. And you're right. I mean, it is unstable. It is high inflation. But actually, interestingly, the inflation in our business, everyone in the advertising groups does well in Latin America. Why? Because it's more wiggle room.
Mm.
Because there's a bit more inflation, a bit more wiggle room. But don't underestimate the people or the resources and their youth. The creative abilities, technological abilities. In Mexico, I'd call out Colombia, new leader there, Brazil, and Argentina, those four countries in particular. Then I would add the Middle East, despite Iran and the problems around Iran, which I think are intractable. I think it's going to continue for a long time. I think that's very difficult to get agreement there. I still think the Middle East, because of its energy, obviously, yeah. Physical energy and from oil out of the ground, is really important. And Asia, obviously. China, there is the Taiwan risk. I don't think there'll be an invasion. I think just China will squeeze. And it is part of Xi's legacy. So that's, you know, it's not, it will never be. The Chinese believe Taiwan is a part of China, yeah. Period. If you're having this conversation with the Chinese.
It's a no conversation, isn't it? Yeah.
Then there's India, which is on fire, you know, growing at six last year, five this year at least, maybe five or six next year. World Bank's top fastest growing country for those three years. Then places like Indonesia, Vietnam, Philippines, Thailand, Singapore. I mean, these are all countries that were full of promise. Africa, very volatile, but there are some countries there that are of interest, but generally too volatile to take a view. And then that leaves us with Europe. And
may I just throw in the pot Japan?
Well, Japan, yes. I mean, Japan, ever since...
I mean, the stock market's up.
Ever since Warren Buffett bought into all four big trading companies, yeah. in Japan, you know, everybody got excited about Japan. It was really interesting. If you remember, he bought when he was still running Berkshire, he bought into each of them. So, yes, I mean, there is opportunity, but restructuring. Australia, New Zealand, interesting, but always, you know, flat oligopolies that trade market share between them. Now, I think that the basic areas are US, Latin America, the Middle East and Asia. Europe, still our clients think of maybe Eastern Europe is slightly different, obviously ravaged by what's going on in Ukraine or hindered by that. But Western Europe, you know, the UEFA countries, mm-hmm. that are under the gun, UK, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, really have got problems that will only be taken care of by a radical departure from existing policies. And clients look at it as a cost opportunity, not revenue.
Do you buy, you've talked a little bit about debt. I know that we need to talk a little bit about AI and about the UK as well. But can I just posit this in front of you? Do you buy the story of good debt and bad, good debt and bad debt? Good debt, i.e. infrastructure, bad
yeah,
debt?
Yeah, I do buy that. I mean, there are things that the government can do, but you have to make choices. If you're running a one point, if you and I and David were running a £1.3 trillion budget, which is what the UK economy is, right? The government spends £1.3 trillion. I think we could find £25 billion from somewhere. Mm. I think we could find 2 or 3% from somewhere, couldn't we? In order to...
But why won't they do it?
Well, because, you know, they make decisions, they get pressure, and they reverse their decisions. So, you know, it's interest groups. We're fighting about a diminishing cake. We've got to grow the cake. So to your point, if we can make infrastructure investments, which we will have to do in order to deal with defense, mm. in order to deal with AI and quantum, which is coming down. You know, nobody talks much about quantum, but stand by. If you think AI is going to have an impact or has had an impact, or is having an impact, stand by for quantum. The computing power that gives you is absolutely huge. And it's going to speed up the implementation of AI extremely effectively. So I think you have to make some choices. And nobody likes to make hard choices. You know, you're running a business. You have to make hard choices. You have finite resources. And you've got to make some calls as to where you invest them. So, you know, I think to me it's really super interesting what's happened on technology in the case of US and China. If you remember when Alibaba and Jack Ma ran into trouble with the regulator over the flotation of Ant Financial, and Jack Ma was banned. And the government, the Chinese government, said we're going to split Alibaba up into 8 parts, I think it was. Today, Alibaba is still one company, maybe Ali and Ali Cloud, but basically still one company. Why is that? Well, number one, because the Chinese understand that big tech is important from a technological point of view, but also from a defensive point of view. And dare I say, offensive too. I mean, you see Ukraine, you see what's happening in the Middle East. These are tech wars. And it's going to be even more so, you know, with companies like SpaceX and everything, and bless his Bezos's Blue Origin and everything. It's going to become more and more important. So technology is at the heart of things. So we have to make some decisions about what we're going to do to stimulate the growth of technology. I don't want the UK to be the best regulator in the world.
We've got to get away from service industries.
I want it to be the best innovator. When Rishi Sunak's government had that conference at Bletchley Park, it was sort of marketed as the regulation conference. There's that saying: the Americans innovate, the Chinese imitate, and the Europeans or the British regulate. And I don't want this country to be the best at regulation. Or I'd like it to be good at regulation, but I'd like it to be best at innovation and growth. And because we do have great universities. We do have great people here. We do have great technological people. But if you've got a technology business here, what do? You build it and then you sell it to Americans. They're the people that take it. Look at DeepMind. DeepMind was sold to Google in 2014.
Do you think the education system has to change in this country? I mean, going back to Tony Blair's, educate. But now it strikes me that with AI, which obviously, Michael, and I'd love your comments on, is it going to destroy what I call clerical jobs? Where is it going to be positive? But it strikes me that children now coming out of university need to find something else because technology cannot accrue. For instance, if you're a plumber, good one, you can make 100 grand a year.
No, you're absolutely right. I'm on the Bloomberg Philanthropies board. And Michael has done, at our last meeting, they showcased what they were doing with Ford Motor Company on apprenticeships. Mm. Michael had gone and said to Detroit a week before the trustees meeting, and had initiated, and he's doing it with other companies too, to create apprenticeships and technologies. So let's say practical education. But going back to VAT on private schools, if the view is, private schools, there should be less private schools and more public education. If the public system could absorb the students and have the teachers and the infrastructure and the facilities to absorb, it would be fine. But we don't.
Yeah.
Right. So all we do is we penalize the private sector, thinking that they can go into the public sector, but they can't. And what we end up with is with general standards, it's this sort of envy driving it. And I get that. And I get that, that people have to have equal opportunity. I get that. But you're going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And so education, yes, there has to be more technical education. There has to be different types of education. And Rishi is very eloquent. Actually, Rishi Sunak was very eloquent on this point and very studied on this point. So yes to all that. But we have to make some uncomfortable choices, just like you're running a company. But yeah. I just come back again. I find it amazing that with a £1.3 trillion budget, we can't make some trade-offs. Hmm. So yes, there will be some investments that we can do in technology. There will be some investments that we do in defense, which, by the way, stimulate the economy. Hmm. That's where the good investment comes from.
Could you elaborate a little bit on AI? Hugely exciting from the United States perspective, but from this country, we seem to be still very much on the peripheries. How do you actually think it will affect, and where's the positive angles?
Well, it's only just starting. So consumers, the irony is that consumers are adopting AI far faster than companies. Where we see corporate adoption is in verticals that have existential threats. So think about the background for a minute. S&P 500, if that's a good proxy, I mean, it's maybe not perfect, but it's
it'll
good
do
because it has overseas profits in it. But the dollar's been weaker, so profits are a little bit buoyed by that. But anyway, put that, it's a decent proxy. I mean, if you look at that, everybody's doing well. So if it ain't broke, why fix it? Right, okay. But in certain verticals, cars, you have BYD breathing down your neck. They can produce an AV for an automated vehicle with God's eye as their technology for $10,000. They can produce an EV for $25,000. Even Musk has difficulty in competing against that. So they, and you know, Stella Lee and the founder of BYD have said they want to be the largest car company in 5 years. And I wouldn't bet against them. It's a bit like betting against Buffett. I wouldn't bet against them. But they are causing a revolution inside the auto sector. So you are seeing massive AI adoption at scale, manufacturing, marketing, distribution in the auto industry. The second area where you're seeing is financial services. When you have companies like Revolut and Nubank, who we work for in Brazil and Mexico, and who've just got a US banking license, and they're launching it on, they're renaming the Inter Miami Stadium in Miami, you know, Messi Beckham Stadium. Yep. That's Nubank Stadium. And they're launching it on through F1 as well. So they are shaking, and Revolut here are shaking the foundations of branch banking. There's also a bit in packaged goods because pricing was taken up during COVID and they can't go much further on pricing and they're getting consumer resistance. And also the three big geopolitical problems, US, China, Russia, Ukraine and Iran are causing supply chain difficulties. So they've got supply chain pressure. So they have to think about alternatives. So in 2.5 verticals, we're seeing it. But the rest, you know, it's tests, it's audits, let's play with this, let's play with that. It's not wholesale change. And in my view, you won't get wholesale change until you get economic pressure. So if, for example, and I'm not saying this is going to happen, but possible, we've seen a very strong first 6 months. Let's say things started to tail off a bit in the second 6 months, you might get, you know, a little bit more faster AI adoption as a result. Because come back to that world that I see, sub 3% global growth, inflation stubbornly at 2.5%, 3.5%, interest rates as a result higher than we were used to before. Remember, we used to have some negative rates, but certainly higher than we used before, and maybe trending up a bit, or either staying where they are now, or so the terminal rate is higher than we thought. In that world, people are going to be driven to find selective geographies and to be more efficient. So AI comes into its own when you get pressure.
So final question, if I may. Could you flag up a couple of sectors for investors that they think they should be looking
well,
at?
Well, I, you know, 50% of our revenues at S4 and Monks comes from tech. So, it comes from Google, it comes from Amazon, it comes from T-Mobile. Yep. So these are the companies that I think are, so obviously tech, healthcare, we're still seeing strong growth there. Those sectors actually, I mean, packaged goods, autos are going to be interesting because they're going to have to change. On AI as a whole, my view is it will reduce employment. I tried to study economics many years ago, and John Maynard Keynes wrote a pamphlet, I think it was in 1930, before the general theory, on the impact of automation, and his conclusion was that we were going to have more holidays. So I think he was right, but he was 100 years too early. So I don't think it's as drastic as Elon Musk says, you know. But it was interesting. Yesterday there was a German guy on CNBC on robotics, and he said, you know, he doesn't agree with Musk in The Economist. You know, that we all won't have any work to do anymore. The dirty jobs will be done by robots, and I think probably we end up somewhere in between. In our industry, it's having a massive impact on producing commercials, how we produce commercials. We don't have to do expensive shoots anymore, and we can do things synthetically. We can personalize ads at huge scale now. So, you know, you're not talking to mass audiences. We're talking to David and Michael as individuals. We know what you do. We know how you do it. And that raises all sorts of privacy issues, but on the assumption you get over those, that works well. And then media planning and buying, which is only just over $1 trillion industry. So BlackRock manages $14 trillion on its own, and we're a tiddly-pom little industry at $1.2 trillion, $1.3 trillion, everything. But you should be able to do that algorithmically. So you are going to have sort of black box marketing where you have creative made by machines with human control. You're going to have it highly personalized, and you'll plan and buy using algorithms. So it will be a end-to-end, ultimately, it's going to be an end-to-end system.
So, Martin, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Good.
Yeah, greatly. Thank you very much indeed.
That concludes this podcast. David and I hope you'll join us again soon.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.